This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Hey, does your toddler seem to know more about the iPad than you do? Well, if so, welcome to the wonderful world of Digitods, the young children who are born into an era of mobile technology. Kids who will never be able to say, oh, I remember before there were touch screens. These kids are learning faster and they're learning better than any other generation that has ever come before them, and they are loving it. Next time you have a chance, take a look at a toddler who's using an iPad or any kind of tablet, and we've all seen them. They are pictures of concentration. Their hands are moving and their eyes are constantly scanning the screen. They are really in an active state of learning. Those neurons are, boom, they're firing on all cylinders. It's not surprising that they're learning such an enjoyable activity with all the bright colors and interesting things and cheery voices that are urging them on. Now, that's the good side. On the other side, have you ever tried to get a Digitod's attention when he or she is working with a tablet? It's certainly not easy. Often the child is so fixated on the work that he protests even if he has to move on to something as interesting as maybe a snack. So here's the thing. Toddlers are racing down the information superhighway, and it's up to us, the parents and adults around them, to get ready for them. And that is exactly what we're going to be talking about in this part of today's Positive Parenting Show. We're going to jump into toddlers on technology and a lot of other great stuff when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
I walk and you drive. So let's make a deal. I'll watch for you and cross the street safely. You watch for me and stop. Think of the impact we can make.
A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Patty Woolman Summers, who's the co-author of Toddlers on Technology. Patty, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about toddlers and technology. Let's kind of lay some ground rules out for us here. What are we talking about as far as toddlers and as far as the kinds of technology we're going to be talking about?
Well, little kids, that is kids under three, have access to technology in a way they never had before because mobile digital devices are easy for a child to use, even as young as one. They have all the requisite skills to use, say, an iPad. They can point, they can swipe, and they can pinch and zoom because they have a pincer grip. So now they have access to applications that a whole lot of corporations have made for them and some very interesting sort of mom-and-pop places. So they are learning at a very early age all about numbers, letters, colors, and shapes. When I was directing a toddler program a few years ago, kids would come in, and instead of being scared of learning or feeling any pressure of learning, they maybe even couldn't speak fluently, but they could run in and point to a wall and go, green, and see a letter and say, K. And they were very, very excited about learning in a way that I'd never seen before. And I've been doing this for 30 years.
And I think a lot of people have got kind of a knee-jerk reaction about toddlers and technology, and that knee-jerk reaction is essentially, oh, my God, how can they possibly do that? That kids need to be playing with blocks and nothing to do with technology, and they should get off those iPads. I think this is one of these situations where you can say that all day, you know, until you're blue in the face, but they think we're going to be moving ahead. How do you put that in there in a reasonable way?
Sure. So, look,
because there's obviously benefits and drawbacks.
You know, of course you want your kids to be playing outside and playing with blocks and playing with other children, but you're not going to stop the technology. It's sort of like someone many, many years ago saying, well, I know they've invented the wheel, but I'm going to walk. You know, it's not going anywhere. So the trick is to make sure your child does some of everything. And that can be done, especially when you start when your children are very young. Establish a routine and stick to it. Maybe if you have a two-year-old, maybe 20 minutes with the iPad in the morning and 20 minutes at night. Something of that nature. And make sure you also have time for doing other stuff.
Do you worry, though, that it becomes a babysitter a little bit too often? It's just too tempting?
Of course it's going to be a babysitter. But again, it has to do with the amount of time that you're using it as a babysitter. For example, here in New York, I see a lot of people in restaurants bringing their children and using the iPad. Now, I'm okay with that if the kids first have socialized for the first half hour. Let's say you go to dinner with your parents or your in-laws, and you want to sit there for an hour and a half. Well, no 2 or 3-year-old's going to be able to sit for an hour and a half. So have them talk first and socialize first, and then bring out the iPad or the iPhone or whatever device you have. I often mention the iPad just because as of now, Apple has designed the best apps for kids. And I know that Android is catching up, but so far Apple's still the best.
Yeah, although the technology itself, I mean, a lot of the new tablets are pretty amazing. So we'll have to see. I mean, the number of apps that are out there. But I guess that raises an interesting question about the apps, because I've looked at a lot of the research about things like Baby Einstein, the DVD programs, and the bottom line of that seems to be that kids who do a lot of the Baby Einstein and Baby Mozart and that sort of stuff, that it's worse for them than doing nothing, basically. Do you worry that we're going to fall into the same trap here, that there's going to be a lot of stuff that's pitched as educational and your baby will be incredibly smart and taller and smarter and more beautiful, and we're going to be actually harming them?
I don't think we're going to be harming them, and I do think they're going to be smarter earlier. I don't know that means they're going to be smarter than they would have been the rest of their life, but they're going to be smarter earlier. So the question is, how do you maintain their humanity? And how do you make sure that they can feel as well as think, that they can have friends? That's what I'm worried about. Is it possible to make sure that you, are, as a parent, are working with your children in many different areas, like meeting friends with a kid their age or making sure there's some imaginative play or playing with blocks? That's the issue. It's not the technology itself. It's what else you do during the day. And I do worry that sometimes people will allow kids to be on any mobile device longer than they should be. But that's the only reason why. They are here to stay.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm certainly completely agree. They're here to stay, and we really need to be doing something to channel that to the most productive way possible. But I kind of wonder whether, you know, it's hard to reach the parents about these kinds of things, because it's so tempting. And I mean, I've had this kind of exactly the same kind of situation that you're talking about wanting to have an adult conversation. And I've got a 10-year-old who has a remarkable attention span, but every once in a while she just doesn't have any interest in the conversation. And so I have given her one of the many tablets we have around the house, and she's incredible with that thing. And I try to be moderate, but I think in some ways, you know, she's maybe in the backseat of the car and, well, we've stuck in traffic, and it just goes on and on and on. And I'm concerned about, for both our sakes, really, whether that's the best thing.
You are actually, I know this is strange, talking about a different generation of child. I'm talking about a kid who starts playing on an iPad at one year of age. And the children who are called digital natives, but who did not start on an iPad at that early age, it's a little harder for you guys, because, and I know because I'm a grandmother of a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old, so I know exactly what you're talking about, because no routine was established for them because nobody started young enough. Little kids at that time had to wait until they were able to manipulate a mouse. So that was 3 or maybe 4, and now that has been the big change. This is children are starting earlier. And so one of the things parents can do that you couldn't do is they can establish a routine from toddlerhood, which is why we concentrated. Our book goes through seven, but it was the difference in the fact that very little kids now have access that made us name the book Toddlers on Technology. We have these activities called seesaw activities. So if you read an app review and then you think about what else you want to do, that would be a seesaw activity. I'm wondering if that wouldn't work for your 10-year-old, too. Once you get to be, you have a kid who's six, if you can work on how they feel about other people, so empathy, you know, and service and good works, that's where I'd like to see the apps go in the future. And some of them are starting to go there. Just the idea of the connectedness that we have in the world, and that would be a great thing.
You know, we're going to talk about this probably in the next segment here, but I just wanted to have you touch on this a little bit about the importance of dexterity and small motor control and things like that, that you're not going to get the same way with a tablet by swiping and pointing and pinching as you would by picking up a block and looking at it from all different sides and dropping it. And you get the, obviously you learn about gravity, and then you throw it somewhere and you learn about how many times your parents will pick things up. That kind of hands-on, literally, kind of experience you can't have with the tablet. How do you, what are they learning, I guess?
Well, they're learning a lot, but they're not learning what you said. And one of the things they are learning, which is amazing and is also something you learn playing with blocks, is they're learning how to problem solve. They may or may not be able to figure out what screen comes next right away or what to do in an open-ended app like an art app. You know, they have to figure that out, and there's nobody there to help them. That actually is the big plus of learning from an iPad. It's learning without the pressure of a parent or a teacher. You guess 10 times at an answer if you're two, and the iPad does not care if you get it wrong. You get it right on the 11th time, they yell and scream and say how great you are and give you a sticker. So that takes a lot of pressure away from learning. So that's the plus side. The minus side is, yes, we need to be able to make sure that we're having real-life experiences, blocks. What could be more essential than blocks? They teach proportion, yeah, balance, and they teach cooperation and problem-solving. So to leave out any of those things would be a real shame. We're aiming to not have our people all grow up like Mr. Spock or the denizens of the Lido deck and Wall-E. Do you remember those guys in the spaceship who couldn't walk and saw everything through glasses?
Yeah.
We don't want that. We want to keep the humanity, and that's why I wrote the book, because I really wanted people to understand all of this is fine in its place.
Patty Woolman Summers is the author or co-author of Toddlers on Technology. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue talking to Patty about technology and the teaching machines. I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, we're continuing our discussion with Patty Woolman Summers, who's the co-author of Toddlers and Technology. And I want to talk to you, or have you talk to us, about what makes a good app for little kids, for toddlers.
So I have to answer this a little bit in the negative first. I'm sorry.
Okay.
No apps that are timed. Nothing like you have 10 seconds to get the right answer.
Okay.
Nothing like that. That's not a good thing for little kids. They need that time. There are apps out there where the characters on the screen frown or cry if you get the wrong answer. You really want to avoid those things. You want to look at an app that has bright colors, that has a little bit of a sense of humor. There's an app for Wheels on the Bus, you know, that song old nursery school kids love. And when they get to the doors on the bus, go open and shut, the doors open and out walks a chicken. That's very funny to a kid. Why does that help? Because it sends oxygen to the brain when you laugh. And it makes them more alert and more interested in learning. So you want to look for that. And then you want to look at your kid. Do you have a child who's counting to 10? Well, isn't that terrific, especially if he's 2? So in that case, don't get an app that teaches you how to count to 100. He's not there yet. Get an app that teaches you how to count to 20. So you want to look very carefully at where your child is and where the next intellectual step is. Also, it depends on what kind of learner your kid is. If you have a kid that likes to go step by step by step, there are apps that go screen by screen by screen, which is great. You can't go from screen 1 to screen 4 just because you feel like it. That's perfect for the kind of kid that goes step by step. I call them the engineer. But then there's kids who love to skip around. I call them the divas. You don't want to get an app that doesn't let you move between screens, like jump between screens, because that kid will lose interest immediately. So those are two ways to look at finding an app.
And the kinds of rewards, though, it sounds like they should be consistent. You were talking a few minutes ago about
right. How
you could get something wrong 10 times. It seems like that's a lot of persistence or perseverance for a little kid to stick with something for 10 times.
Yeah. Probably the very little kids, they'll go up to 6, maybe not 10. 10 more between 2 and 3. But I've seen an 18-month-old work with a shape app, and there's 6 different shapes, and they're asking the kid to find the circle. And if he picks the other 5 first, and then he picks the circle, they still get excited and have kids laughing and clapping on the soundtrack. So that's what I mean. Kids do persevere. In fact, that's why we named the book Toddlers on Technology, mm-hmm. to sort of hit the drug light aspect of it. You get a dopamine squirt in the brain just like you do from, say, chocolate. And it helps kids want to continue. In fact, one question I'm always asked is, yeah, I can get my kid on an iPad, but I can't get her off. What do I do? So if you have a little kid, when you tell them, okay, we're going to look at the iPad until the big hand's on the 2, however you want to say it, and then we're going to pick something that's a fun activity for them. Tell them what is coming next after iPad time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say, like, if your kid hates a bath, don't say we're going to play with the iPad and then we're going to go to bath. Why would they want to give it up?
Well, how do you do that? I mean, how do you figure out whether you've gone too far?
So look at your day, right? If you can possibly avoid, for you as a grown-up and for your kid, using any digital device right before bedtime,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Your brain's always going to be stimulated and it's going to be hard to go to sleep. I have to sometimes try to remember that myself. It's not so easy. So that's something very, very important. That's one way. And another way is look at who your kid is. Does he love blocks? Does he love reading? What's more important than reading? Do you know, so I meant to tell you, so far as we know, you can't learn to speak from an iPad. You can't learn to speak from an app. You need to be looking at people's faces and their expressions in order to learn to speak. And so it's very important that you make sure that you have that face-to-face time with your child. So what is your child like? Does he like books? So that's what you say. You say, all right, we're going to do iPad, and then we're going to read these books. You can pick them out. That's a good way to go.
Now, I want to have you go back a little bit to the apps, because I think a lot of people, you go to an app store, and there are a billion of them. I mean, literally a billion of them out there. And how do you possibly assess, and how do you learn? I mean, you have a great chapter on taking into consideration your child's temperament and learning style. I mean, some kids have got a incredible ability to persevere, and other kids have got an awfully low frustration tolerance, and they're going to explode if they don't get something right the first time. So how do you know where to even look? I mean, because you can't put in frustration tolerance into the search box and come up
right.
with much.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Well, that's why one of the reasons we wrote the book was to provide you with app reviews and then activities you can do after that. So certainly you mm-hmm. can look in our book, but another place you can look is a wonderful organization that has a website called Common Sense Media.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
we've had them
they
on before.
Provide reviews of apps, and then they let parents right next to their review, spatially on the screen, is parents' reviews. And why I love that is parents always say it's for younger kids than the reviewers do. So let's say parents say a two-year-old, the reviewer says a three-year-old. Right there, you've got a range, depending on your kid. Now, besides that, another really good thing to remember is that you can download a preview for free for almost any app. They'll do one screen or two screens. So you get a chance to see if you think it's good for your child before you actually have to pay for it.
You know, a lot of parents, and we've talked about this at the very beginning of the show, it's going to be a babysitter in a way, which means that the parents are not necessarily completely aware of what's going on. And so one of the things that concerns me, and even of the kids, your grandchildren's age and my children's age, that, you know, I don't know what sort of messages are coming at them. And some horrible percentage, I think it was a Common Sense Media study actually not that long ago, a really outrageous percentage of apps have got some kind of push notifications or asking for information or stuff that we would prefer that marketers just don't know about our kids. But if they're in the back seat or sitting even across from you at a table while you're having adult conversation, you don't know what they're doing.
It's really true for your age kids and my grandchildren. It's scary. I would have to say that's pretty frightening. I know some people have bought separate devices for their children and locked out some of these things like YouTube and stuff. I think this is going to be a large question in the future. Some of the time, though, you're just going to have to monitor, even if it means peeking over their shoulder and seeing what they do. This is why I thought it was so important to start when your kids are very young, so you can show them this is okay, this is what you get, but here's the stuff that's not for you till you're older. There is no shame in saying to a child, that's for when you're older. It means you're in charge. And you know what? Kids like to hear that, even when they pretend they don't. They know they're not in charge.
So where would you look for apps that you can do with your child? Because it seems like that might help a lot of parents. I mean, it would certainly help me if I had a kid that age. I'd like to be doing, sure, great for them to be doing some stuff on their own, but it would be helpful to see how they're behaving if we can do something together.
So, let's see. There are some wonderful apps out of Stanford. They're called Leo's Pad, and the star is Leonardo da Vinci, like a cartoon drawing, beautiful. And he's got a friend, Gally, and they've got Marie Curie also as a friend. And their science apps are a very good place to go. The Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, they have wonderful history apps. Science apps, they're not cut and dried in the sense that there's one answer. So you could really, really enjoy looking at that with your children. There's other apps. There's a company called One Globe Kids, and this woman, Ann Glick, has gone all around the world and photographed kids in so many places and put it online in a story form. Here's what a kid is like who lives on a mountaintop in Haiti. Here's what a kid is like, you know, who lives in the Middle East. So when you look at the lives of other children, that's a very good kind of app to do with your kids. Rather than the cut and dried, here's a count to 10, here's the letters. You know, look at something that has more of a narrative in that. And then you give your input, which is very important.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
phrase.
That's that phrase interactivity we're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. Having the back and forth is going to reinforce those messages.
That's right.
Patty Woolman Summers is the co-author of Toddlers on Technology. And is there a website, Patty, that people can go to for more about this?
We named these kids because they're a brand new generation, Digitods, short for digital toddler.
Great name.
So the website is digitod.com.
What a great URL. Patty, thanks very much.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
How's that cook?
How do you change the ringtone?
How much does this cost?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life, except...
Any questions?
No.
At the doctor's office, ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and Sam Fuse is here. She's my partner on the Parents at Play column that you can get at parentsatplay.com. And we've talked about some of our differences in the way that we approach things, and I'm kind of a board game and that sort of thing kind of guy, and you are not. And as I was looking at more board games, the house is full of them, I discovered, you know, there's so many of them that the boards themselves are basically square, and they've got spaces, and you move through them. And so I thought, you know, it would be interesting to write a column about board games where the boards are a little bit different. And that's how this particular column was born. The first one that I had took a look at was called Don't Panic, and it's a Goliath game. And it's a really a very simple game. It's got a bunch of questions, and you do move through a board, but it's kind of an oblong, odd shape. And it's just one of those games that you can sit down, you can play from it. What's nice about it is you can play from 2 to 18 players. You rarely see a game that goes up quite that high. And so you spin a spinner, and it tells you how many spaces that you can move. It's just a basic kind of a quiz game sort of a thing. Is you have to answer questions, and you have what happens is the hilarity comes up when people are trying to come up with five television shows that have the word orange in it or something like that. And that's what the questions on the cards are like. You guys got to play more games, Sam.
Well, my husband and son play the games. I am just not the biggest game player on the planet. I get bored with board games. It's, you know, a double entendre for me.
Why is that, do you think?
I hate them with a red-hot passion.
Well, I guess there's that.
I could just find so many better things to do. I just don't like sitting there staring at a board. And everybody's always fighting. Oh, it's my turn. He took my candy. I want to go two spaces. And the loser's always screaming, and the winner's always gloating. It's just never any fun. I just don't like it. Although, honestly, when adult things happen, like adult games, and I don't mean adult games, but, you know, like party games, like categories kind of thing, Pictionaries things. Those can be fun in small groups with sane-ish people.
Yeah, if you know them, I suppose, and you can kind of let loose in front of them, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
The next one was also a Goliath game. It was a word search game, and I thought maybe this would be something that Sam would like, because it's not exactly a board game. It's round, and it's a word search. I mean, everybody knows what these things are. It just looks like a jumble of letters, and you have to find words in there. What's kind of unique about this one is it's again, it's round, and it's kind of on a lazy Susan, and the words that you're searching for are around the edge. You're looking for one word at a time, and everybody who's playing, there can be four players or four teams, are looking for that one word. And whoever sees it first grabs a hold of this thing that they call a totem, which is just like a squeezy dog toy that just squeaks. And of course, our dog got to it and took the squeaker out of it, so we no longer have that anymore. But there's something that can say, hey, I found it. And then you put down translucent round things on the word. So the idea is whoever gets by the end of the show, or the end of the turns, and there's like 25 words in each one of the different options, whoever gets the most tokens on the board wins. But
do you want your color up there?
You want your color up there, but what happens is if I get a word and then somebody else gets the word that intersects mine, they can take off all of my tokens from my original word and put theirs on. So you never know what's going to happen, and you really have to be very on top of things. You think you could be way ahead, and you could end up losing the game. As your son, for example, gets a little bit older and he starts reading word recognition and letter recognition, it could be a fun thing for him. And
play with his father.
You could do it
too.
Or
you. Yeah. You can play games with him. I'll send him to your house.
Okay. Well, he can spend the summer with me. All right.
Perfect.
All right. So the last one I want to talk about is called Skateboard Madness.
That one actually looks kind of shape-wise. It's a very interesting shape.
It is. It's like two skateboards that are crossed. And so there's a bit of a double entendre there, is that there's the skateboards, but there's also your goal in Skateboard Madness is to win the X Games, where the skateboards are. And I got to tell you, I know nothing about skateboards. So this whole thing was a terrific learning experience for me. And my daughter, the 10-year-old, she knows everything about everything, and so she was kicking my booty up and down there. But it's really, in a way, it's really complicated. There's all sorts of different types of cards that you put up, and you roll the dice, and you can move a certain number, and you have to do tricks. It's hard to explain, but what was really interesting was, despite all the complexity of the rules, and you can't do this, but you can do this, and you have to do this, and this adds up to that one, is that you catch on to it really, really quickly, and it all makes a lot of sense. It's very intuitive. And
And you could injure each other. So that was also interesting in a board game.
Yeah, and what was fun is it came with bags of little skateboarders and little snowboarders. And I couldn't figure out how they fit into the game, but they were just sort of fun to have around the house and to move around the board. But it's great. I mean, if you are interested in skateboarding, you really appreciate integrating a lot of the vocabulary, ollies and things like this that I had no idea, and half pipes and quarter pipes. And then they've got names of the big shot skateboarders. And also, this is the only game that I've seen so far that where you can pick up sponsors as you're going through it. It's like, what?
The Hunger Games.
Exactly. You have the sponsors and some little bird comes in and drops something.
Right.
But yeah, so you get...
Gives you some soup, it'll be fine.
Yeah, you get monster drinks sponsors you. It's really fun. And
awesome.
I learned a tremendous amount as far as the vocabulary and a little bit about the skateboarding thing. There are a lot more reviews of these products and a lot of other products at parentsatplay.com. For Samantha Fuse, I'm Armin Brott.
I don't recycle. I mean, we can just find another planet for your kids to live on, you know?
Noted non-recycler Tommy Crenshaw talks about the future.
Oh, I can totally see finding another planet that can support life when ours fills up with trash.
Log on to yougottabekidding.org and learn about all the ways you can recycle, unless you're into lame excuses like Tommy's.
Hey, recycling's just not my thing. Starting over on a new planet? Now that's exciting.
Don't be that guy, unless you want people looking at you funny. Log on to yougottabekidding.org.
Hey there, and welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting for Military Family show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. Acceptance is a fundamental human need that really has kind of fallen through the cracks in modern-day parenting. Parents should focus on accepting their children for who they are and allowing them to find the path that's meaningful for them, but a lot of us struggle with understanding what and what not to accept. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Nancy Rose, who's an acceptance advocate, and she's going to show us how parenting with acceptance results in raising well-adjusted children. When acceptance is the starting point in parenting, it builds a warm, solid, connected foundation for a lifetime relationship of mutual respect, says Nancy. On the other hand, when children are not seen or understood, they begin to tuck away pieces of who they are, leaving them vulnerable to negative influences. What we're talking about here is not really the unconditional acceptance of what your child does. It's the unconditional acceptance of the things they can't change about themselves, things Nancy calls the core self. If we can leverage acceptance of that core self and we can guide their behavior, children can become the best versions of who they are. On the other hand, the lack of acceptance from parents damages kids and harms society as a whole. I'm Armin Brott. We'll jump into our discussion of the great things that can happen when parents lead with acceptance, as well as some specifics on how to actually achieve that when positive parenting continues right after this.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Nancy Rose, who's the author of Raise the Child You've Got, Not the One You Want, Why Everyone Thrives When Parents Lead with Acceptance. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Armin.
What's the child you've got, and how does that child typically differ from the one that you want?
Well, every parent, every expectant parent has a fantasy of who their child will be. It's normal and natural. We always, you know, imagine parenthood. Some of us from a very early age imagine what parenthood will be like. We always have this picture of what our child or our children will be like. And again, there's really nothing wrong with that. The problem comes in
when the child that we actually have differs dramatically from the child that we've been imagining or wanting or hoping for. And that can lead to a lot of problems.
So how do you begin to get past that? I mean, everybody's got preconceived notions, so I mean, sir, no pun intended, I guess, about this whole thing. I mean, you expect something. It would be the same thing as you go to a blind date and you expect something. You have some idea. Somebody's told you a little bit about the person, whether tall or short or good-looking or not,
right,
or whatever, and it you have to kind of spend a lot of time backpedaling to readjust those expectations. How do you begin to let yourself go, let the ideal child go?
Well, you know, it varies for different parents. And some parents have a relatively easy time with it. They can deal with the child that they've got, and they don't really have a problem with it. And, you know, they might even laugh and say, oh, I thought I was going to have, you know, an artist like myself, but, you know, my daughter is a tomboy. But it's not a problem for them. Other parents struggle more, and it can be for a variety of reasons. But one very common reason that parents struggle is because there's some unresolved issue within themselves that they haven't dealt with, and they may be looking to their child, not consciously, but on some level to fulfill some unresolved issues or some unlived dream, something mm-hmm. like that.
And I remember doing some research for one of the books that I wrote about fathers and kids in school-age kids, and found a really interesting study that was looking at high-achieving parents, especially high-academically-achieving parents, people with PhDs and master's degrees who have more education than the average person, and how they were more affected and more hit by having a child with special needs than parents who had less education and less high expectations.
Yeah, well, I think that probably plays right into what I'm saying, which is that you have to adjust your expectations once the child is there in front of you. And, you know, parents of special needs children generally have to learn this very early on. They don't have a choice. And so, you know, that adjustment gets made early once they have a diagnosis and they have an IEP and a plan for dealing with their child. The reality is spelled out for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents of more, you know, so-called, you know, mainstream kids or kids without special needs, they may differ, you know, quite dramatically from the view of who they should be that their parents have. But no one is, like, telling the parents, hey, you know what? You might want to really look and see who this child really is. And that's why I wrote the book, because I didn't think parents really had a way to understand who their child is and how that may or may not play into the parents' expectations.
You know, you probably haven't gotten to this, but I'm very curious about whether this same sort of disconnect between expectations and reality exists the other way. Whether you grow up as a child thinking or expecting that your parents are going to be a certain way and they're not the way that you imagined them or you wish them to be, is there something, kind of a level of acceptance that kids have to go through as well?
Well, that's a fabulous point. It's really worth talking about, because a lot of reaction that I've gotten from people towards the book has to do with adult children and their parents. And, you know, there's this longing on the part of many adult children and on the part of many, you know, parents of these kids to really be able to reconnect or to connect maybe for the first time. And it does require adjustment and acceptance on both sides in that case. Because, you know, you've got a whole lifetime of experience built up. And as children, we grow up, we see our parents as gods. I remember being crushed the first time my mother couldn't spell a word for me. I didn't understand that.
You know, it's such a foreign concept. I mean, parents are supposed to know everything, yeah.
Exactly, and she said, let's look it up in the dictionary. I was like, what? I was really crushed. But learning that your parents are human and fallible is a huge part of our human development.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the flip side of that also is that when parents are struggling with their children and want to bridge a gap, a disconnect, humility on the part of the parent in admitting their, you know, their faults or their fallibility to their children can go a very long way.
Yeah, I guess if the child sees that you're not trying to be phony about stuff, I mean, it probably would be a lot worse if you had a parent who pretended to know stuff and then you found out secretly rather than having the parent actually say, you know what, I don't know, just like your mother did. Hey, you know what, let's go look that up together.
Right, but if you think about it in terms of everyday life, so many parents actually do posture that way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I know what's best, and, you know, don't question me. And even when they feel insecure about something, that's when they might put their foot down even harder because of their own anxiety, rather than, you know, I'm not really sure here, let me look into this, or I don't really have an answer for you right now. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I think it's a fascinating topic, and we'll probably have to have you come on to talk about that. But I want to get back to the parent-child and accepting the child that you've got. Let's talk about the acceptance part, because you talk about the power of acceptance. What is the power of acceptance? How what's the power in it?
Well, acceptance is a fundamental human need. It's right there along with, well, I don't know if you're familiar with Maslow's pyramid.
Oh, sure.
Hierarchy of needs. Yeah, that's sort of a standard in psychology. And, you know, if you look at Maslow's pyramid, at the bottom are the basic human needs of, you know, safety and security, shelter, food, elimination. And right in the middle of the pyramid is acceptance, a sense of belonging. It is a fundamental human need to feel a part of something and accepted in that group. And it struck me when I was doing my coaching, parent coaching, and then as I was starting to formulate the book, that it has fallen through the cracks in modern-day parenting. Acceptance, rather than being given up front to our child for just being who they are, has become a system where so many parents give acceptance when the child meets their expectations, when they behave a certain way, when they achieve a certain standard of whatever the parent believes is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's backwards. So,
well, where's the line between acceptance and a healthy push towards more success? I mean, I know you can do this. Come on, you can make that basket or whatever it is, as opposed to just saying, well, okay.
Right. Well, acceptance, I want to make that point. I'm glad you brought that up. Acceptance of who a child is does not mean acceptance of bad behavior or of, you know, maybe not bad behavior, but just lackadaisical behavior or whatever. Acceptance is reserved for the things about the child that you can't change. And these are what I call the 9 traits of the core self. A child is born with certain traits. Every one of us is born this way, and they're present at birth, and
yep.
they're not going to change substantially over a lifetime.
I'm speaking with Nancy Rose, who's the author of Raise the Child You've Got, Not the One You Want, Why Everyone Thrives When Parents Lead with Acceptance. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with Nancy about the traits that make up the core self and a lot more great stuff. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, we're continuing our discussion with Nancy Rose, who's the author of Raise the Child You've Got, Not the One You Want, Why Everyone Thrives When Parents Lead with Acceptance. I promised everybody that you were going to be talking about the elements that make up the core self, so why don't we start with that?
Right. Well, you know, we're each born with certain traits of our personality pretty much ingrained, and we can't change that. We can manage those traits, and as parents, we can help our child manage where they fall on these spectrums, but we can't change them. So Let me just list what the traits are, and it'll give parents a little better idea of what we're talking about. The nine traits start with activity level, adaptability, distractibility, ease with the unfamiliar, intensity, optimism, persistence, regularity, and sensory reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, every parent knows that, you know, if they have two kids, one is so active from birth or even in utero, and the other one is, you know, much less active.
Right.
And this is evident from birth and doesn't really change much over lifetime.
And
like
people may know those characteristics you're talking about as temperament. That's kind of been talked about in by Stella Chase and
right, and
other
these
people.
Are based on the nine traits of Stella and Chess. Although I tweak the title somewhat to make them a little less derogatory in some cases, because I don't believe there is a positive or negative in any particular
mm-hmm.
level of any trait.
Yeah.
And also to make it a little more user-friendly for parents. I think first reaction is the way Stella and Chess described what I call ease with the unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think parents can really tell what that means when I say ease with the unfamiliar.
No, it doesn't matter what you call it, but it is one of those things that I think you're absolutely right, that you would look back and you would see that your child has been that way from moment one, and you can learn to accept the child. It seems that, though, part of that, since you're bringing this whole thing up that's related to temperament, is sometimes there's an element, it seems to me, in what you're talking about of learning to accept yourself as well before you can really accept your child.
That's exactly right. So much of this, when there are real conflicts between parent and child that can't be resolved with just the early early work that I set out in my book, the reason is that a parent needs to look inside themselves and really get honest with themselves about who they are and how who their child is may or may not be triggering them. I call these hot spots. And hot spots can result from two particular instances. One is when a parent and child are so alike in a trait. For instance, you know, they're both very intense, and so they might butt heads constantly, or they're both very, very persistent. Neither one wants to ever give up. And so they're butting heads constantly. So that's one way that it creates a hot spot. Being very much alike in a trait can also create a hot spot when the parent doesn't want to believe that they are a certain way, but they are. So they see something in their child that reminds them of something that they don't want to recognize in themselves.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember when I was reading about temperament the first time, I remember thinking after reading it fairly carefully that, you know, after all these years, you mean I'm not nuts, that I don't like going to parties where there's lots of people I don't know,
uh-huh.
and why I will stand in the corner eating carrot sticks instead of socializing. I mean, you know, they realize, okay, so I could see that somebody who had that particular attitude, which I did for a long time, could be fairly critical of a child who started doing the same thing.
And, you know, what's the likelihood that they will, because these traits are, you know, inherited. But, for instance, in my case, I have always been very intense. I have an extremely high intensity level, and in my family that was a problem. And so I tried to ratchet that down my whole life, you know, and I didn't really live with ease with my own intensity. And so when I had my first child and he was so incredibly intense, just like me, I didn't see it. I did not see it for a long time, and in fact, it was my own mother. But I did have problems with it. I couldn't
mm-hmm.
stand it.
Right, yeah.
And it was my own mother who said to me, "But Nancy, he's just like you."
Ah, there you are.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nancy, I want to make sure that we get to the second part of this. We've been talking about acceptance, but the leadership component, which is something that I think was especially interesting about how you begin to use this knowledge that you've got? And now that you're accepting, or maybe you're not accepting, but how does leadership fit in?
Leadership is an extremely important element in the equation. And for your readers, or for your listeners who haven't seen the book, leading with acceptance is a double entendre. You start with acceptance of who the child is, but then you need to be a leader, a parent leader, who then guides your child to become the best version of who he or she is. And so a lot of times at workshops that I give, a parent will ask a question and say, okay, you know, how do I deal with my lazy teenager? And so I'll ask the questions, okay, let's figure out in this scenario what aspects of what's going on have to do with this child's temperament and something that a parent needs to accept, and what aspects of what's going on deal with the child's behavior, and it's up to the parent to guide that behavior.
Well, item number one, it seems like, would be to try to find another word besides lazy, which tends
to push you one way or the other. It's very derogatory, and if you want your child to believe that they are lazy and don't like to work, just keep calling them lazy, right? But
it's magic, yeah.
But, you know, and oftentimes in this kind of a circumstance, what it boils down to is a complete lack of leadership on the part of the parent. And I ask them, well, I mean, do you emphasize your family? Do your children know that they are part of a family, and as part of a family, they have certain responsibilities to the family, and they get certain benefits from being in the family? Well, no, not really. Okay, do you have, you know, standards of behavior, what you expect your child to do? Well, I try to. I say, okay, well, do you hold them accountable? Do you check to see whether they've finished their chores on time? Oh, you know, sometimes. Okay. Well, are there consequences, bottom line consequences, that if your child has not, you know, perform the chores the way they were supposed to, then they encounter the consequence? Well, most of the time I just end up doing it myself or whatever. So the parent is not being a true leader in the family. They're letting the child rule the roost. And why wouldn't a child rule the roost in that circumstance?
Well,
someone
yeah.
has to fill the
yeah.
vacuum, right?
Well, so what does the leadership look like then in that kind of a situation?
In that situation, well, I started talking about the different aspects of leadership. I've boiled it down to the six leadership tools, I call them. One is to emphasize the family. And two is to establish standards of behavior. Three is to hold the child accountable. Four is the bottom line consequences, enforcing those consequences. And then the fifth and sixth tools have to do with, they're a little more advanced. One is the language of leadership, which you alluded to just a minute ago, and that is finding the words that are positive and that are leadership words, and calling a child lazy or stupid or you never listen to a thing I say, that's not positive language. I messages rather than you messages is the way that some people describe that. And then the sixth tool is walking the walk, I call it. You can't just tell a child how to behave. If you want a child to do their chores regularly without being asked, look at yourself. How are you? Does your wife have to nag you to take the trash out? Do you sit on the couch ignoring her requests? And so walk the walk. And, of course, it goes both ways. I'm not picking
on
husband. Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Nancy Rose is the author of Raise the Child You've Got, Not the One You Want, Why Everyone Thrives When Parents Lead with Acceptance. And where can people find out more? You got a website?
I've got a website. It's nancyjrose.com.
Excellent.
And they can also go right to Amazon if they want to buy the book. And it is available in some Barnes & Noble stores as well.
Good. All right. Nancy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.